Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion of healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions and emails here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I hope you enjoyed last week's interview, and I know that a lot of people have flu on their minds, so I thought we'd begin today's program with a little discussion and a little background information. So influenza is a virus, and it has some special characteristics that I'll be coming to in just a moment. We refer to this virus by its two major antigens, which are proteins on the surface of the virus, hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. Now, these proteins have a recognizable shape. The virus needs them to infect cells. They are, in fact, very specialized enzymes, which are specific to the cells of the host. Now, the human immune system functions a little bit like a barcode reader. The human immune system is distributed throughout the body, but it acts like a barcode reader and scans every protein that crosses its way and categorizes it as self, harmless non-self, pathogen, and unknown. Now, if the barcode signals pathogen and it's been seen before, then antibodies are there to disable the pathogen, and special cells already are produced which recognize the pathogen. If, on the other hand, the barcode reader comes up unknown and there's simultaneously in the bloodstream a distress signal from body cells indicating that the unknown is infecting and damaging cells, then the innate immune system kicks up. This has no memory. This is a four-alarm fire. The innate immune system is the one that we recognize from being ill. It's the one that gives you fever, slows you down, gives you body aches, makes you feel sick. In fact, people who take interferon for treatment, let's say, of hepatitis C will describe a flu-like syndrome. And that's because interferon is one of the innate immune system actors, one of the things that slows down viruses. And so that's what it feels like when you're viral. Now, back to those specialized enzymes, H and N. Flu virus is an RNA virus, and it is segmented. It's actually segmented into eight parts. Now, usually viruses have one long chain, and that is what gets reproduced. Having eight segments allows for rapid mix and match recombination of RNA and accounts for the rapidity with which the flu virus mutates. That's why last year's flu vaccine may not work for this year's flu. The H and N might have mutated or changed more than your barcode reader can account for. So the barcode reader of your immune system doesn't register this new strain from the switch from H2 to HN to H1, let's say. And so it doesn't register it as a pathogen. And therefore, you don't have neutralizing antibody. Now, remember, I said that it's species specific. That's why bird flu stays in birds and swine flu stays in swine. So when this rapid mutation process in the virus comes up with an H or let's say an HN combo that can actually jump to another species, that's, well, Houston, we have a problem. It is then that the first step in the potential for an epidemic occurs. So here's a probable scenario for the current situation. Somewhere out there in Mexico, there's a large animal farm with lots of pigs kept close together. A mutated animal flu shows up and is very aggressive and very, very contagious. It jumps around through all of the swine, and then it has a mutation occur with all of those copies being made frantically. You've got lots of generations, lots of opportunity for evolution. And one of those strains jumps to the human farmers, and from there, it stops, or it doesn't. If a second mutation has occurred that allows it to jump between humans, now we're two mutations deep, then nobody has immunity. everybody gets sick. And remember, I said this is an aggressive virus. So initially, when you have this jump from an animal cohort of virus to humans, and you have that second mutation that allows it to be contagious amongst humans, the initial virus tends to be extremely aggressive. And we've seen this before. So how does the flu kill you anyway? It turns out there are really two scenarios. The most common scenario for the flu killing you is it takes the weakest of the herd, the very young or the very old. Usually, it just further weakens an already weak entity, and then a bacteria moves in to make the actual kill. Now, scenario number two is the scary one. This is what happened in the 1918 influenza epidemic. The healthy adults get the sickest. And this is because the innate immune system, remember, that's the one that goes after the unknown protein when there's also a cellular distress signal. Well, remember, this is a very aggressive virus, so you get a big distress signal. The innate immune system goes on turbocharge, institutes a take-no-prisoners attack, and ends up killing the host. In this scenario, the people who have the weaker immune system are the ones who survive because they don't have enough innate immunity to be activated to kill them. That's why this outbreak was so alarming initially to health officials worldwide, because that's where the initial die-off came, in the adult population, not the very young and very old like we would expect. But already after a week, I'm starting to relax a little. Why? Well, Darwin to the rescue. Natural selection has saved the day. The initial very, very aggressive H1N1 swine flu that showed up in Mexico was just too lethal for its own good. And it mutates fast. So each generation contains some virus with different characteristics. And in this case, virus that's a little less fierce in its attack. So this one allows people to be walking wounded, walk around for a few days, coughing and sneezing and spreading it before they take to their beds. This doesn't put people down after 6 to 12 hours and really wipe them out and kill them. Now, with people going to school and going to work and flying home from spring break, this kinder, gentler version of the H1N1 spreads throughout the planet. So far, we've got 15 countries. Who knows what it'll be next week? The people who get the kinder, gentler H1N1 get immune to the whole cohort, including the very, very aggressive version. Because remember, the immunity is based on the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase. So even though other characteristics of the virus, in terms of how aggressive it is, will be different, the immunity will occur. So it's actually acting like a vaccination. Now, they tell us the vaccine won't be ready for 6 months. Now, that's in time for the next flu season. And you better get that vaccine because H1N1 is new. And so when it comes up, if you're old, so let's say over 65, if you have an autoimmune disease or you have something that threatens your ability to survive a large infection, such as diabetes or a heart condition, or you're very young, get that vaccine. Meanwhile, and I'm saying this half in jest and half seriously, I'm in my position as a physician, I'm likely to be exposed. If I find someone who's been sick for, let's say, 4 days, is 20-something, and is not deathly ill, and tests positive for the H1N1 influenza A, I might just expose myself. For the rest of us, standard precautions, hand washing, avoiding touching your hands to your mouth and nose, don't eat candy or food with your fingers unless you've just washed your hands. If you can avoid air travel, then I suggest you do so. If you're sick, you should avoid air travel. If you get stuck in an airplane next to someone who's coughing or sneezing, have a mask in your pocket to take out. That's the same advice that I gave back during the SARS epidemic, and it's good advice. One of these little masks in your pockets, if someone next to you is coughing or sneezing, lose the embarrassment and pull it out. In our archives, we have an interview with historian John Barry. It's the February 2005 show, and it was about the great influenza of 1918. In there, you can learn more about how the scary scenario plays itself out. Key features of why 1918 was bad was that it just happened to hit, and this happens over and over and over again, but it was a perfect storm of circumstances. It was during the mobilization for World War I, and lots of people were moving all over the country, going off to war. There was a lot of movement. There were a lot of opportunities for people in train stations and train cars to get exposed, two or three days later that when they started to cough or sneeze, they were in a barracks somewhere in the United States. And before you knew it, it was out in the community and it was a major problem. There are a lot of lessons to be learned about how to handle a true pandemic, and many of them are in that interview, so I urge you to listen to it. One thing I want to say, I want to applaud the government of Mexico for actually taking steps to shut down the government offices and discourage people from mixing and matching viruses. I think that was a wise move. There's been a lot of Mexico bashing this week. I think there's a tendency to blame the victim. And I think they actually did a pretty decent job once they realized what they had on their hands. As far as whether we should be closing schools in this country, I think there's been a little bit of an overreaction, but that's understandable when you don't quite know what you're dealing with. In general, with flu, it's better to overreact initially and relax when you've given it a couple of weeks and you see what the amplification rate is and you see who's dying. That's what tells the tale. When you start to see these weaker, milder cases showing up, like I said, it's Darwin to the rescue. I wanted to start off with a couple of emails, and let's do that. I've got one here from Ron in Salinas. Excellent question. What effects does a lifetime of poor eating have on a 16-year-old body? My daughter has been a picky eater since birth or soon after. No vegetables, some fruits, mostly starches, potatoes, breads, rice, meats, red meat, sausage, chicken, some fish, eggs. She refuses to take vitamins. She used to cry at the dinner table with healthy food sitting on her plate. We did not force her to eat, but she was the very last to leave the table after all was cleaned up. Early on, her physician recommended we leave her be. Now there is absolutely no convincing her. I'm afraid ill effects may show up later, especially if she plans on having her kids of her own. If I have the proper information on health effects, perhaps I can convince her that she needs to think of her future and not just the present. What can my wife and I do, and would this be considered an eating disorder? She's 5'2" and 120 pounds, and is particularly strong-willed in everything she does, says the loving father, currently healthy, with cholesterol approaching the upper limits of normal. That has me a little bit worried. We'll come back to that. Ron, excellent question. I think that what you have on your hands there is a super taster. Some people are exquisitely sensitive to the bitter flavor of the healthy flavogens and bioflavonoids in food, and she may be one of them. This is the characteristic presentation, someone who just will not, cannot abide vegetables. I'm glad to hear that she does take fruits, and so where I would start is amplifying and exposing her to a great number of fruits and trying to get one of the major colors, a yellow fruit, something in the citrus family, some of the blue fruits, maybe grapes and blueberries, other berries as well, pomegranates perhaps. And once you've identified a variety of fruits, she should eat more fruit, maybe mixing frozen fruits in a shake. She could take a protein shake in the morning for breakfast if you can get her to do that. You might be able to sneak some liquid vitamins into the protein shake. You put enough blueberries in there, then you might be able to actually get her one very good nutritional meal a day. And then fruits for snacks, fruit leathers. Exploit the fact that fruits come in all colors of the rainbow, even kiwis, right? So you've got the green fruits. Work on the fruit angle. She will get a lot of substances that she needs that way. And while I would love to see her get more sulfur in her diet, because that's something that's mainly in vegetables, you may have to sneak that one in through supplements like N-acetylcysteine powder in her shake. At 16, it's all about palatability and coolness. Good luck. And we're going to Jim in Big Sur. Hello, Jim, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I'm 66, get a lot of exercise, hiking and stuff. About 6 months ago, I started noticing if I'm spending 3 or 4 hours sitting at the computer or something, my left ankle starts swelling.
Mm-hmm.
And it can swell so much that my foot can swell and it can hurt.
This is a new thing.
This is new to me, last 6 months. Okay. I just had ultrasound the other day.
And I'm sure that it did not find any blood clots, correct?
They found old blood clots.
They did. Ah, oh, interesting.
Same thrombosis, but not acute, and they're not worried about it.
So 6 months ago, you might have gotten a blood clot, and with that blood clot, blown out one of your valves, which often happens as you resolve a blood clot. the valve in that area is damaged and starts to leak. This is called post-thrombophlebitic syndrome.
Uh-huh.
And it sounds like you may have a case of it.
Okay. So I'm going to make an appointment to see the vein specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me that it's very likely what they're going to say is get a compression sock. I want to get those old clots out of there and repair a valve. Is that not...
Not this century.
Why is that? I mean,
because we don't know how.
The veins are right under the skin, and they can see them on the screen.
You're right, but we can't make the valve regrow. We can't do structure, essentially. In a lot of blood vessel things, we can't really rework the microstructure. The valve's a fairly delicate mechanism. It's a flap of tissue. We can't get in there surgically and create a artificial valve. We don't have any kind of valve prostheses. And you can't take a valve out of a pig or out of another human's leg and sew it into the vein and get it to work. Like we can do with heart valves, for example. We are able to do porcine pig valves and stick them in people's hearts. And you can actually transplant a pig valve. But that's much bigger, actually, than the, you know, we're talking about something that's about the size of a walnut versus something that's about the size of a pea.
Right.
Part of it's just what's humanly possible or technically surgically possible at the moment. You can't have what you want there.
Okay,
you could remove the vein, and then the other veins that don't leak will actually expand a bit and pick up the slack. That might work.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you could overtax the other ones and they could start to leak too. But if it's really uncomfortable and unpleasant, one solution would be to remove the leaky valve, which is to say remove the whole vein and hope that the others will take up the slack. And a compression stocking will be necessary after that surgery for a while because initially you aren't going to have the excess drainage capacity. So your swelling will get worse before the other blood vessels can expand to take up the slack.
Okay, so the valve is sticky and it doesn't have blood flowing the right direction. It backs up and that's...
No, it's the opposite. The valve is supposed to keep the blood from flowing downhill. When you stand up and you compress your calf, that squeezes the vein, it squirts blood up towards your heart. Then when you relax the muscle, the valve flaps down and keeps the blood higher than it was the previous time. So it's a series of step-laddering up.
Okay.
And essentially, while it's relaxed, it's leaking back down.
Okay. So when I start to get a couple of little pains, I know that's about to begin, the swelling's about to begin. What I do is I get up and I run up and down the hill.
Right. And so you're pumping and you're pumping it up real fast and you're outrunning the process. Another thing that you could do would be to try to sit with your leg elevated when you're at the computer.
I put my foot on a little box, so my knee is higher than my hips.
You might that might help. Getting it even higher would be good.
Yeah.
If you could lean back, put it on the desk, and get a longer keyboard, bring the keyboard back,
Right. Maybe
expand the size of the letters on the screen so you can be 3-4 feet back with your foot up.
Okay.
The higher you get it, if you can get your ankle at the height of your heart, you're
the
in real good
you
shape.
Go, the better you are. Okay.
You're in real good shape.
Now, what about these old clots? We just leave them there?
Yep.
Can't they break off?
No. It's only the fresh clots that break off. They're still not super glued together. Essentially, if you think about rubber cement's a good analogy. When you first take rubber cement out, it's pretty drippy, right?
Right.
But it hardens up,
right,
and it cross-links. And once it's fully cross-linked, it doesn't spontaneously come apart any longer.
Okay.
And eventually those will actually get digested, and most of them will get digested and removed over another 6 to 12 months, but some of them will remain in the walls and kind of create a little irregularity on the surface.
Okay.
And there is potential for another blood clot. Did you have an injury or prolonged immobilization? Did you take a long plane ride or something? How'd you get it?
I had, starting about 20 years ago and then 10 years ago, I have had two injuries to my left foot, the soft tissue.
Yeah, I think it was more recently than that. I think something happened 6 months ago or maybe 7 months ago and started this going. But I don't know that for sure. And no one can really tell you for sure. That would play the odds.
Right.
I'm going to wrap this up because we have some other callers on the
line.
Thank
you very much. I appreciate the help.
Thank you very much. Good luck to you.
Bye.
Keep running. Let's go to Mary in Santa Cruz. Hello, Mary, and thank you for waiting.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
Just a comment on that last call. I have leaky veins in my legs, and the procedure that I'm signed up for, as I understand it, is to cauterize them and then force the blood into new veins. So that's how I'm dealing with my leaky veins.
Yeah, it depends on how large the vein is. The cautery works for the small ones.
Okay.
Those are the ones that tend to cause little spider veins on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He sounds like it's one of the bigger veins, the pencil veins.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why I'm calling this morning is about a virus that is not the flu.
Okay.
I seem to have been subject to lots of viral attacks this month, starting with a very bad cold that was viral, went into a sinus infection, resolved itself. So for the first couple of weeks of the month, I was knocked out by this cold, and I felt good for about a week. And then, say, Monday and Tuesday of this week, I again had a slight headache, sore throat, and by Wednesday, I have a head-to-toe rash, total rash. So I've been to my doctor.
What antibiotics did you take for your sinus infection? Okay.
And it was 10 days after I was off of 10 days of Augmentin that I got the rash.
I'd still put drug rash at the top of the list. I haven't seen your rash, but the timing still fits. Go ahead.
Even though it's so long after I quit.
2 weeks. Up to 2 weeks after you stop the antibiotic for a drug rash.
Okay.
Go ahead. You went to your doctor.
But I also have a slight sore throat and, no, actually, it's getting worse, sore throat and headache, and just don't feel well.
And you need to be checked for strep. Did they do that at the doctor's office?
My sore throat wasn't extreme at the time I was there, and I've never had strep throat in my life.
Yes, but you have a sore throat and a headache and a rash, and that's a very streppy sounding picture.
Okay,
so I'll get checked for that.
Okay. I can go to urgent care today and do that.
Yeah, you should do that.
What they check for is my blood count and for the, I'm going to call it a virus. I don't know that that's what it is that causes fifth disease.
Mm-hmm. Right, parvovirus.
Yes.
Yeah.
But those haven't come back yet. Mostly I'm just concerned about, in the meantime, how do I know when I'm not contagious?
Well, with respiratory viruses, it's typically when you start to feel better, you're much less contagious because the feeling better part means that you have now got antibody and you've knocked the thing back.
Mm-hmm.
If you're coughing and sneezing.
Almost not at all.
All right. So you're not probably very contagious. There's somebody you really don't like, offer them a drink from your Coke.
Okay.
But otherwise, you know, don't kiss anybody that you like for a while until this is cleared up.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a sight. It's like measles, but it isn't measles, but just head to toe.
Yeah, but amoxicillin, which is what's in Augmentin, is notorious for causing a rash.
Okay.
And the timing is still possible. I applaud your doctor for thinking of parvovirus. They're searching their differentials. That was good.
Right.
But I would still put drug rash at the top of the list.
Any way to determine if that's what it is?
Not really.
Okay.
Not that I know of.
So what she said it looked like is a viral rash.
Right. So it's pretty hard to go out in public right now with a flu scare, with a rash all over your body.
And a mask.
Yeah, exactly. You're just like, send out for pizza, I guess, is my advice. And
I'm doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't think you're actually very contagious.
Good.
And it's certainly not been a feature of the swine flu.
Oh, I know it's not swine flu.
I know. I'm just throwing that out for people who might wonder. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Actually, that was one of the phenomenon in one of the New York Times articles I read prepping for the show. Someone was talking about, you know, all you have to do right now to be a complete social pariah is cough in public, and everybody is like suddenly 10 feet away from you. Let's go to Renee in Santa Cruz. Hello, Renee. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
More vein questions.
Okay.
I was diagnosed with a blood clot in my lungs.
Right.
Recently, and I'm on Coumadin. But the doctor said something to me very strange in the emergency room. She said that usually when you have blood clots, there often can be cancer somewhere in your body.
Well, that'll freak you out, won't it?
Well, I was having a bad night to begin with since I couldn't breathe.
Yeah, you had a pulmonary embolism, and they tell you might have cancer. Okay, the skinny on that is that there's a thing called hypercoagulable state, which means you're clotting easily. So who gets blood clots? People with prolonged immobilization, like someone who's just had surgery. Some surgeries are notorious for it. But, you know, you can just have a fractured ankle and be laid up a little bit, but that'll do it. That'll let the blood gel. Basically, if the blood sits still and doesn't circulate, it starts to coagulate.
Oh.
So it's move or coagulate. So anything that reduces the movement and allows for pooling, including just getting stuck in coach class on a 747 in that middle aisle and then having the security folks tell you you can't get up to pee, will do it. You can easily get a blood clot with air travel. Females, because of estrogen, tend to get more blood clots. If they're on estrogen replacement postmenopausally, their risk is higher than if they're not. Birth control pill users, more likely. Pregnant women, more likely. You get picking up a theme here on that one. Estrogen is pro.
Right.
Estrogen
is pro. Right. I'm 62. I'm not too worried.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, for the general public, though, estrogen's procoagulant. An injury. If there's an injury, then the compounds that trigger coagulation, notably collagen, may be exposed, and plus you'll get swelling, and that slows down blood flow, and you're back to the stasis equals coagulation situation. Then you come into mutations. There are about 5 different relatively common mutations where you have a little too much or a little too little of one of the 20 different critical proteins that are part of the blood clot cascade. And so you clot a little more easily, or you don't break down in your clots as quickly as other people. That will sometimes lead to a pulmonary embolism spontaneously. We always look for atrial fibrillation. And a lot of people have a hole in the middle of their heart that's harmless unless they get atrial fibrillation and get a blood clot in their heart. And then they can get a pulmonary embolism that way. Oh, let's see. I think I've covered most of the common ones. Now we get to the cancer, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. So when you have cancer, sometimes your bodies make more of these various proteins, these clotting proteins, and you clot more readily.
Okay.
So that's where the cancer comes in. So if you've gone through all of the other possibilities and you can't figure out why this person, they don't have any other risk factors for a blood clot, and they're over 50, then you might say to yourself, gee, I wonder if there's an occult cancer. But if they don't have any symptoms, they haven't lost any weight, and they've got a clean mammogram, don't have any blood in their stool, you're sort of up a tree without a paddle to tell someone, well, you might have cancer, but we don't know if you do, and we certainly can't find it. Of course, that's true for all of us, by the way. That's absolutely true to all of us, to a person. I just wish she hadn't said that to you, because it's kind of like the witch doctor pointing their finger at you and saying, you will die by the full moon. And then you're walking around thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen? And then you trip over a branch and fall off a cliff because you're so worried about dying before the full moon. So I really hate telling people stuff that they might have something that I can't prove that they don't have.
Yeah.
I'm sorry she was thinking out loud. My philosophy is keep the differential to yourself, doctor. I try not to share the differential diagnosis. That's for Dr. House and his colleagues to discuss in the corridor, not in the room in front of the patient. Because the differential diagnosis will always include really nasty stuff that the person probably doesn't have. But if it gets into their head, you can give them a serious case of medical student's disease.
Yeah.
You ever try to talk somebody out of believing they have Lyme disease? I don't recommend it, because you can't disprove Lyme disease, really, definitively.
Oh.
And so once the person has it in their head, they'll fight for that diagnosis.
Well, the question that I had on top of that was my own doctor. I mentioned it to her.
Mm-hmm.
Said, well, we're going to put you through a series of tests, you know, screen outs.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why can't I have, and this is my question, mm-hmm. why can't I have the blood test that shows markers?
Oh, you should have that.
Why do I have to go through all of the invasive tests?
Oh, you mean the blood test that shows cancer markers?
Yeah.
Because it's not accurate.
Oh.
That's why. The blood tests for cancer markers are used to monitor a cancer that you've already got. I mean, we run them, and every now and then we find a cancer that way, but they're not good screening tools.
Oh.
They're like the prostate, like the PSA. They'll be a little high, but not high enough to really prove anything, and then you're chasing it, and then you find nothing a lot. Or they'll be normal, and the person will have a rip-roaring cancer, but this cancer has lost the ability to make that protein, so it's no good as a marker for that particular cancer.
Oh, okay.
So there's accuracy issues. Realistically, what you do at 61 is, I would, first of all, get the blood test for coagulation abnormalities and make sure you don't have one of those, because then you can stop. Once you find a good reason for you to have had a blood clot,
mm-hmm.
you could stop. You don't have to keep hunting. So if you have protein S deficiency, you're done.
Mm.
They may have even done that in the hospital, but if they didn't, you should get those tests. And that's called a hypercoagulability panel.
Mm-hmm.
So assuming that you had that and you're normal on all of those, you know, you would go for the highlights. So you'd screen for colon cancer. Get a colonoscopy. It's not too horrible.
I've had one.
Yeah. So you get another one and you get a mammogram, maybe a chest x-ray if you have a smoking history.
I've had that done.
Since the blood clot?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, of course, you had chest x-rays done. You had a pulmonary embolism.
Right.
And you probably had a chest CT, too, come to think of it, if you had a pulmonary embolism.
Right.
That's fairly common, so you've ruled out, really thoroughly ruled out lung cancer.
Would an abdominal contrast reveal any cancer? Is it something you would still have to have the colonoscopy?
You could have a virtual colonoscopy with a CT scanner, and that, in this situation, I think would be an adequate substitute.
Because I just had an abdominal.
Mm-hmm.
CT scan to make sure I wasn't bleeding from the Coumadin into my stomach.
There's a special type of test.
Oh, special. Okay.
Test they do with rectal contrast.
Okay.
Called a virtual colonoscopy. And it is done with CT scan, but there's some technical differences between just a regular abdominal CT.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm don't know the technical differences, but they are different.
Okay.
But we know that the resolution on that is decent.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason we don't use it or encourage it for screening, it's a lot of radiation for screening. You're not going to want to do it every 5 years on everybody. And if you do find something, you still have to do a regular colonoscopy to go after it. So you can't get a biopsy. We do have the potential of chasing a wild goose here.
Okay.
All right. I wish I had a more definitive answer, but it's very hard to prove a negative.
This is just such a mysterious thing to me. And the Coumadin scares me.
Yeah.
But
well, you won't be on it forever. And I would love to see a substitute for Coumadin because it is such an annoying thing. I will tell you something. I don't know how you're fixed financially, and I know your insurance won't cover this. But for about $2,000, you can get your own INR monitor. So you can get a little finger stick device, and it's expensive. Like I said, it's about $2,000. And you can monitor your own coagulation. So if you're willing to put up the money, if you're worried enough and want to keep a tight lid on that, rather than going in, you know, once a month and potentially having...
I actually go in every week.
Well, you'll eventually graduate to once a month.
Oh.
Once you stabilize and they figure out your dose.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good luck to you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
Yes, I just turned 72 and back at the end of January, I had the venous ablation procedure. And so I would like to perhaps share my experience with that gentleman who called.
Okay, this was a radioablation phlebectomy.
Yes.
It's called ambulatory phlebectomy.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, I've had a problem with my left leg for quite some time. I injured it in a bad skiing accident back in my youth, and I also inherited some serious varicose veins, particularly in the left leg.
Mm-hmm.
I inherited them from my mother, and it got worse over the years, and I had a huge bulge of,
right.
of veins coming out at the top of the calf behind my knee and other areas too on the calf.
Mm-hmm.
For the last 20 years I've been a vigorous hill walker and hiker with my partner, but I began to find that I was having blood pooling around my ankle at the bottom of my leg, and I actually developed an ulcer on my ankle.
Mm.
So 4 years ago, I began wearing a compression stocking on that leg, a knee high, and if I ever left them off, I would have this pooling occurring again.
Right.
So around that time when I started wearing those stockings, I consulted with a local surgeon. And at that time, he checked out my veins and told me that my veins were too far gone for any treatment that was then available.
How long ago was that?
About 4 years ago.
Okay, your surgeon was unaware of the existing technology, because I know this has been around for at least 8 years.
I'm told not in this country. I mean, it's been going on in Europe for 10 years, but I'm told the particular procedure that I had has only been happening here for a couple of years. This is what I was told, at any rate.
Okay, well, I can't argue the fine points because I don't know, but there have been radioablation venous procedures being taught to American doctors for at least 10 years, and okay. It may not be exactly the same device or procedure. Anyway, we're quibbling
yes.
here. Please get to your point.
So I had it done, and I think this might be appropriate for the gentleman. For a couple of weeks after the procedure was done, the procedure involved threading it up about 45 centimeters from the middle of the calf up to the top of the groin,
mm-hmm.
and then gradually removing it as it heated, boiled the blood, frankly. And there was some discomfort for a couple of weeks afterwards, and I had to wear a thigh-high mm-hmm. compression stocking. But within a month, the bruising that I had and the discomfort had gone away, and I was able to return immediately to my vigorous
walking,
hiking and walking, and I haven't worn a single compression stocking since then, and the bulge behind my knee is gone, and I can show my leg in public again.
I'm very happy that you had such a successful result, and I would hope that our previous caller would also have a problem in the superficial circulation, which is what you're describing. From some of the things he said, I surmised that his problem was more likely to be in the deep circulation, which cannot be eliminated by that technique.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's a wonderful thing that we do have this ambulatory phlebectomy procedure for superficial varicosities like yours. And I think the vein specialist that our previous caller said he was going to go see would be well aware of the competing technologies. If he's a vein specialist, he certainly should be. Thank you very much for sharing your experience.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Carolyn in Corralitos.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. The reason I called is, a few months ago I woke up with, when I opened my eyes, I got incredible pain in my right eye. After a while, it felt like there was a big grain of sand in my eye. And every time I blinked, it hurt. And anyway, I was going to the eye doctor anyway for, new glasses and stuff. So he looked at it and said, yeah, you've got dry eye, which he said was, for some older people, the hormone that produces tears kind of quits working. He said, well, you just have to put this glop in your eyes every night
mm-hmm.
and, give me some recommendations on that. So I started doing that, and it's like putting this Vaseline in your eyes.
Right.
So then I also went to an herbal store because I thought maybe there's something else. It seems kind of, this is the only thing we can do.
Yeah, it seems like there should be a plant hormone that would mimic the teardrop hormone. Were you successful in finding something that helped?
Well, I got this herbal dietary supplement. It's some concentrated tea leaves in little pellet, little teeny pellet kind of things, pills that I take twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to act on the liver.
Right. That's Chinese medicine now.
Yeah.
That's
mm-hmm.
absolutely Chinese medicine, because in Chinese medicine, the liver meridian, one of the functions of the liver energy is to moisten and affect the eyes, just like the kidney is associated with the ears.
Ah.
So there are these internal associations in Oriental medicine, and that's how I knew from your saying that, okay, this is TCM we're talking about. So you've only been on it for a couple of weeks. That might be a little bit short for seeing results, but any results so far?
Oh, yeah. It really, within a few days, it really did help quite a bit.
Cool.
And he did give me some aspirin eye drops for when it didn't work.
Right.
Which is effective.
Yeah.
I don't usually see TV commercials, but I saw a TV commercial for some sort of a drug that was specifically for dry eye, and I didn't know if this was an option that made sense.
What was the name of the drug?
I don't know. It was very quick. I kind of caught it out of the corner of my eye.
Well, I would go back to my ophthalmologist and ask.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what drug that was.
Okay.
They're always coming up with new and improved drugs, and now that the FDA lets them, a lot of people do go straight to the consumer, which isn't much fun.
Right.
For me.
Right.
So I can't really help you with that one, but I'm
okay.
So pleased to hear about the Oriental medicine, and I wonder if you would be willing to go to my website and just give me the name of the actual agent, because I wasn't aware there was a drug that worked that well from the Oriental medicine pharmacopoeia, and I intend to make use of it.
Oh, I'm happy to do that. I was mostly calling just to find out if you knew of anything else, and is it actually really true that this is something that, is a hormonal thing that happens to some people when they get older?
I've always thought of it more as being a deterioration of the tear duct itself, or rather the tear-making organ, the tear gland, lacrimal gland. So I hadn't heard that there was a hormone. My frame on the Sjogren's and the dry eye was always that it was deterioration of the lacrimal duct, but maybe there's a hormonal mediator there that I'm not aware of.
Okay. Okay, and you don't know of any other treatments? Did you want to know that one I'm working for me?
No, I don't.
Okay, thanks so much.
I think you got 17 in blackjack here. You should just, you found something that works. You should keep taking it.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Edward in Watsonville.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. Under my knee, and this had been since I was a little boy, every time it would swell up, you know, about the size of a golf ball, and I could just kind of, like, rub it away. And now I'm, like, in my 70s, and even though I can, like, push it down, I still end up with a chunk in there that feels like cartilage.
Mm-hmm. And this is located where?
Right under the knee, so where the bump of my knee is.
Under the kneecap?
Is right under that.
Okay, so it's... All right, so I think what you have there is a ganglion cyst. The other possibility is that you've got a herniation of the bursa, the bursal sac. There's a gel sac there that protects the knee, and you can get kind of a herniation in it where it'll stretch out in one part. And then when you push on it, you're pushing the gel back into the main sac.
Mm-hmm.
A ganglion cyst is coming not from the bursal sac, but from the synovial tissue, which is essentially the joint capsule. And it's the same thing. It's a herniation. It's filled with fluid, and you can squeeze it back into the joint. But then when you put pressure on the joint again, it tends to pop back out. And maybe you're not able to get all of it back out now, and that's why you've got your little cartilagey thing. Could have happened in an injury, as you said, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Right.
I don't think it's anything to be alarmed about, but it would be one or the other of those two things.
Okay, so I can just forget all about it and just rub it down when it comes up.
There you go.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much, Dr.
Thank
Dawn.
You very much. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi. What can I do for you?
You were talking to that previous caller about cancer screening tests, and you mentioned PSA, and I wanted to get your thoughts on my situation, which is a PSA situation. I recently have been told by my urologist that my PSA numbers are sort of scary, and I've gotten a couple of biopsies.
Mm-hmm. What number do you have? What is your PSA number?
Gone from about 2.2 to about 3.3 over the last 5 years.
And you're how old?
45.
Okay, so 2.2 to 3.3 over 5 years?
Yeah, but also went down to 1.4 in that time. So it went from 2.2 down to 1.4 and then up to 3.2.
All right. So your number is still below 4, which is the threshold for where we have an additional test called the percentage-free PSA.
I've gotten that test too.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we don't really know what to do with the results under 4 because all of the studies that set up that probability curve were in people whose numbers were over 4. So we don't know if it's linear and that we can extrapolate the curve downward. So it's harder to know what to do with the information, but is your percentage-free PSA high?
16, I don't know whether that's high.
No, that's on the low side. So maybe there's something else going on, but those don't sound super scary to me.
Mm-hmm. And I guess he had said something like the standards changed. I got some letter that said, well, 2.2 used to be normal, and now new research has shown that that's stronger than we think.
Yeah, well... Let's talk a little bit about aggressiveness. You've got 5 years worth of numbers here, right?
Yeah.
And so if you actually had a cancer that was making PSA over 5 years' time, I would expect it a much more rapid curve. If you gave me this change from a 2.2 to a 3.3 in 1 or 2 years, I would be worried. Over 5 years, especially if it's fluctuating, you said it got down to a 1 and then went back up.
Yeah.
That's a little less worrisome. It's one of these things where if it was 1.2 5 years ago and now it's 3.3, that's different. I heard you said it was 2.2 5 years ago and now it's 3.3. Did I misunderstand?
It was off the 2.2 1 year ago.
Okay. So what you have is you have a test that varies. It's still below the threshold for action. You've had two normal biopsies. I think you should get a second opinion from a different urologist who is perhaps a little less aggressive, because I don't believe that the data support this level of aggressiveness, and I think you've been turned into a person with disease unnecessarily.
Okay.
I think you've got the witch doctor's curse going here.
Okay, well, thanks.
I'd get a second opinion. Bye-bye. We had an off-air caller who wanted to know about masks. Are they for protecting others from your coughing or protecting yourself from others? He heard on some news report that they don't really protect the wearer very well. Well, the major reason that we have surgical masks is so that the surgeon's germs and the nurse's germs don't get into your open wound in the operating room. And then we have a sort of ritual of when we are in, let's say, a TB ward or something like that, we put on surgical masks. And from the standpoint of protecting you from tuberculosis, they do pretty well because TB particles are fairly large. Now, relative to something as tiny as a virus, I don't see that if you have virus floating around in the air, I agree, the mask is probably not going to protect you that fully. You'd need a respirator, which is why in, you know, the hot zone and in movies like that, they wear respirators. It's because you need a good tight seal all the way around, and air is going to leak in the sides of the mask. That being said, in the case of the influenza, I'm more worried about picking stuff up on my hands that the person has coughed or sneezed into their hands and then touched something, and then accidentally scratching my lip or picking my teeth or scratching my nose. And wearing the masks is a very good way of protecting me from accidentally touching my face, which is how most of us get viruses, not from breathing them in. So that's my answer in terms of, does it protect you from others or does it protect others from you? And I'd say the answer is both for the reasons I've just outlined. We have time for one quick email, and I want to put that one out for Tamara in Salinas. Tamara had a potassium score that was a little bit elevated on a recent blood test. We use potassium as a water softener instead of salt. We drink this water after it has gone through a reverse osmosis system. Could this be contributing to the high score? I don't eat more than one banana all day and a handful of dried fruit, peaches, or apricots. And then she goes on to tell us more about her health concerns, isn't taking any medications. So basically, Tamara, I think that that potassium level was probably an elevation caused by some of the red blood cells having broken open. This is called hemolysis, and it is by far the most common reason for a potassium level being slightly above the norm. Kidneys are very good at regulating potassium unless we mess with them with drugs. And if you're not taking a whole lot of herbs, then you're not taking anything that could raise your potassium level. And I suspect it was probably a lab fluke. If you're concerned, you could have a single potassium repeated for about $20. Even if your insurance didn't pay for it, it wouldn't break the bank. And my bet is that your blood cells broke open, the needle might have been too small, the specimen sat for a while, and that caused a false elevation in potassium. I am not alarmed by that, nor do I think it represents a disease process. We've come to the end of another hour, and I've enjoyed it, and I hope you've enjoyed it as well. I hope I've helped clarify some things for you. I hope you've enjoyed the process and learned a little bit. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.